B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, the guy using your member number at the snack bar, Charlie Nance.
Hey there and welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. As you're listening to this, the PGA Tour is in Mexico for a World Golf Championships event. And honestly, I'm not sure if J.B. Holmes is not still lining up a putt somewhere on the back nine at Riviera. Look, don't get me wrong. I like J.B. Holmes. He's a very pleasant guy who was very accommodating and fun to talk to when he won the Wells Fargo Championship here at Quail at 2014. And then when he came back to defend the title in 2015. His problem, it isn't that he's just slow. Grandma's Molasses refuses to offer him an endorsement because he makes them look too fluid. Last year, when he was in contention in San Diego, I thought Jason Day was going to kill him. And I can promise you, JT and Adam Scott were up for his execution on Sunday. See, here's the dirty little secret about slow play and slow players. You know who it doesn't bother? That's right, the turtle who's playing slow. Everyone else is being driven insane. If the tour doesn't call someone on it, if they don't penalize these snails, if it doesn't cost them money, then guess what? It turns into an unfair advantage for the slow player, and that's not right. Seriously, taking 2 minutes to line up a 20-foot putt and then sending it 10 feet past? Good Lord. Hey, this week on the show, we revisit some conversations as this host is on golf assignment down in Myrtle Beach. Details on that next week. Ken Hissom is truly an artist at putter and club restoration here in Charlotte. John Feinstein is an award-winning author whose latest golf book is one of fiction called The Prodigy. But we begin today with Jim Moriarty. This was recorded a week or two after Arnold Palmer had passed away, and it regards his fabulous book, Playing Through Modern Golf's Most Iconic Players and Moments. Jim, your book chronicles the exploits of just about every major player of the last 30 or 40 years. I want to start with Nicholas with this thought. If Seve hadn't spit the bit in the middle of the 15th fairway on that Sunday in 86, if Norman hadn't thrown up all over himself in the middle of the 18th fairway on that day, if Jack had not won that 18th major, and regardless of any of the other 17, the only highlights you see are the 86 Masters. Those are the signature moments of Jack Nicklaus's career to generations of golfers. If that had not happened, what would be the moment or moments that we would remember Jack for?
Well, you know, I mean, he's become such a quality elder statesman honestly, you remember him a lot now for the way he talks about the game and the way he embraces the game. But it's funny you talk about it. Had he not won a certain number of events or a certain number of majors? There was a panel once at Golf Digest of all the great instructors, and they're all sitting around this table, and somebody said, "Well, all right, who's the greatest instructor of all time?" And somebody said Jack Grout, and they said, "Well, it couldn't be Jack Grout because, you know, he's only got one pupil." And somebody said, "Well, yeah, but that one pupil has won 12 majors." And then somebody around the table peeps up and he says, "There isn't a person seated here that couldn't have kept him from winning 11.
That's very true.
he's the greatest champion the game has ever known. I don't know. And had a couple of things not gone his way, I'll bet you there would have been a couple of others that would have.
You mentioned this briefly in the book, and I thought about it last week when Mr. Palmer's memorial service was going on. And goodness knows we all love Arnie, and we all love Jack. But I can't get out of the back of my head. The one time that both of them I felt like were on the wrong side of the history was in the Casey Martin situation.
I couldn't agree more.
Privately, I have a feeling that Arnold probably would have looked back and said, "I'd have done things differently." Do you know if Jack feels that way?
They both feel that way. And both said so, quite publicly, as a matter of fact. They both regretted the stance that they took at the time. And I think once you got to know Casey Martin and appreciate what he went through, I think they were swayed. And the thing that occurs to me is, you know, we spent so many years in the 80s and 90s, you know, waiting for the next Nicholas. And frankly, I think we will be waiting a lot longer for the next Casey Martin than we will for the next Nicholas or the next Woods. Because to play at the level he was able to play at with the physical infirmities that he had was just beyond imagination.
Jim Moriarty is the author of the book, Playing Through. He's our guest, Taking Dead Aim. You know, Jim, I guess I knew this, but it really occurred to me again when I was reading about Seve and Faldo and Norman, and even Curtis Strange to a certain extent, who I've had on this show several times, and I love him to death.
Me too. You know, it's so funny because I've known Curtis since he was I covered Curtis when he played in the Western Amateur so many years ago. You know, I've known him since he was 19. And what a good guy. He must have been a great guest for you.
Oh, he's fantastic. You know, but time has a way of softening
exactly
people's memories of the men themselves. Like Hogan, for example, all of these will be remembered as great golfers, and they were great golfers. But when they were in their prime, by their own admission, by Curtis's own admission, they were not the nicest guys in the world.
Curtis was as tough a nut as there was. You didn't go anywhere near him if he was playing.
No, and he said, look, I wasn't interested in making friends. I was interested in winning trophies, and I get that. But why is it that time has a way of softening our memories of the men themselves?
Well, you know, I think the men change as well, just as we do. I think it's okay to remember that Curtis was a tough SOB when he was playing, just as Hogan was a tough SOB, and so was Faldo. I think we can remember that and also appreciate the fact that as that fire goes out, as it diminishes, they begin to embrace the things that they don't have to perform anymore, and they can embrace what they've accomplished and sort of have a contentment in what they've done. I think we share in that. And people ask me all the time, you know, do you think Tiger and Phil will ever be friends? I say, you bet they will be. Of course they will be. When they get to be, you know, when they get to be like Jack and Gary Player, and because they appreciate that they brought out the best in one another. They were the best of each other.
Oh, look, when Tiger this week was supposed to play with Phil requested it, and I really believe that was an olive branch of friendship of, hey, man, you're coming back. I want to be there with you. It'll be easy. It'll be just like old times.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, it is when you read Jack's book, and he means this, that he never would have been Jack Nicklaus had it not been for Arnold Palmer and Lee Trevino and Tom Watson. And those were the people that made him Jack Nicklaus.
Jim Moriarty is the author of the book, Playing Through, Modern Golf's Most Iconic Players and Moments. He's our guest, Taking Dead Aim. Jim, I love that you wrote about John Daly.
Oh, yeah.
It can be argued, because I think I've argued it several times, no one ever squandered more with more talent to me than John Daly. And I think at times when I look at Bubba Watson, he's kind of a modern day Daly. Daly's demons were booze and gambling. Bubba's demon apparently is Bubba. And, you know, maybe my memory is softened, but I don't remember JD ever being passionately disliked by his peers and definitely not by the fans. Why is it that Bubba Watson can't seem to get out of his own way in this respect?
You know, I don't truly know the answer to that. I'm not sure anybody truly knows the answer to that except Bubba. I do know that growing up, things weren't always that easy for him. And, you know, I think a lot of times when you don't have the support system, that you can suffer from that. And I think John Daly suffered from that as well. I don't think there was a support system for him to kind of get him going in the right direction. What I associate, the piece I did about John, I invoked Ray Floyd, whose wife Maria had a real heart-to-heart talk with Raymond that he recounts. It's a story he recounts, and talk about tough guys now.
Yeah.
It's a story he recounts with some frequency that, you know, he just decided he was going to WD from a golf tournament and went back to the hotel, and he was throwing everything in a suitcase so he could go to a dog track someplace in Florida. And he says, looks at Maria and says, come on, let's go. And Maria looks at him and she said, I'm not going anywhere. I am not going anywhere. You are only 31 years old. If you want to change careers, that's fine. We'll change careers. But otherwise, you're going to stay here and you're going to play golf. And she just took him to the woodshed. And he said it was like somebody hit him upside the head with a 2x4. And all of a sudden, he didn't squander his talent. You have to honor your own gifts. And in a way, John Daly didn't do that.
Jim, speaking of tough people, you wrote a whole chapter about Lady Inkster. Julie Inkster, to me, is one of the all-time great grinders, male or female, golf ever. And when you were talking about her, and specifically the 2014 Open that took place down here in Pinehurst, you mentioned something, and I couldn't believe it because I never heard anyone else articulate it but me. And I totally believe this. I think the golf gods give all the great ones one last walk in the sun, whether it be Hogan in 67 at Augusta, Jack in 95 at Augusta, Inkster on that Saturday at Pinehurst. All the great ones get that one last walk in the sun. And it's because of this and this belief that I hold out hope that we will be given one last brief glimpse of Tiger being Tiger. With the events that have taken place this last week, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about him.
I couldn't agree with you more. I truly could not agree with you more. I don't know what that is. I don't know if there's some sort of magical thing that they just have to empty the tanks of that last bit of heroic golf that they have inside them. I don't know what it is, but all the great ones have that moment where they just, for that one last flickering second, feel the way they felt when they were 26 years old.
Well, yeah, watching at Turnberry and a couple of years before that, remember Norman made a run at the Open Championship?
God, yes, and the only thing that you wonder about is whether or not whether Tiger's body is too damaged to allow that to happen. I don't think his heart or his mind is that damaged, but his body might be. And I think, to me, Tiger wants to be, the reason he would withdraw at the last minute from Napa is he wants to put something out there that's respectable because he wants to be respected. He wants to walk away from the game when he does as a respected figure in the game, which he should be. He was a colossus, somebody that played the way he could play. He deserves to be able to walk away from the game with his head held high. His body may just not let him. We just don't know that.
Jim Moriarty is the author of the book Playing Through, Modern Golf's Most Iconic Players and Moments. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. I wanted to mention Payne Stewart. Every time that I tee it up or caddy for my son down in Pinehurst, I'm reminded, of course, of the 99 Open. But you also recall something in the book that I've heard recounted by many people who were there. And this may have been Payne Stewart's finest moment. It has nothing to do with U.S. Open. Right. And that is how he handled the anchor match in 99 at Brookline with Colin Montgomery.
Oh, that's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And when you see what the Ryder Cup has devolved into, and the occasionally boorish behavior of people in the crowd, Payne came to Colin's defense immediately. And when it was over and the Americans are celebrating, the first person that Payne looked for was the lady who was at the time Colin's wife to apologize. And he tried everything he could to protect Colin that day. And Mike Hicks, Payne's longtime caddy, said that he was never, ever prouder of Payne than he was that day.
It was the day that he really became a man in full, because it could be argued early in his career, in fact, when he won his first major, Payne's behavior at time bordered on the boorish. And for him to come all this way was really something special.
It was. There's no doubt about it. And everybody that knew him well would tell you the same thing.
I wonder what we were robbed of by him leaving so early in life. I mean, I feel certain
we were robbed of one hell of a Ryder Cup.
Yes, There's no question he would have captained a Ryder Cup or two. No question.
We were robbed of one hell of a Ryder Cup captain.
Get you out of here on this, Jim. You close things out in the book by talking about Spieth, Day, and Rory. And the arguments go back and forth. Who's better at this time? Who's better? I like to look at it like this. I'm a big eyeball test guy. If all three are firing on all cylinders, who are you taking?
If all three are playing as well as they can play in every phase of the game, I'm taking Rory.
See, I am too. This last Ryder Cup and the way.
I tell you what, it would be a hell of a three ball, wouldn't it?
Oh, really? Well, you know, we got a little taste of it in the match play last year with Rory and Day in the semifinal. And I knew we were watching something superhuman when Rory hit it 365 down the right center of the fairway, and Jason Day looked at him and said, "You're first." You hit it 365 and you're playing first? Check, please. I'm out of here. Yeah, but, watching the way he finished up in the FedEx Cup, and then, he was like Maximus in the movie Gladiator at the Ryder Cup, taking on an entire nation at times. There's just something about Rory when he is on top of his game where it looks effortless and just unbeatable.
Yeah, I mean, when he lost his putter for most of last year, this past season. But when the putts start going in and the way he hits the ball, it's just, oh, boy, it's scary.
The book is Playing Through Modern Golf's Most Iconic Players and Moments. That's author Jim Moriarty. And when we return, John Feinstein takes dead aim at his latest golf book, a work of fiction called The Prodigy, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top five Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. John Feinstein is the award-winning author of numerous golf books. We talked about his latest, a work of fiction, The Prodigy, last fall. So ever since Bo Hostler went into the lead at the Olympic Club as a high school sophomore several years ago at the U.S. Open, I've had this wild notion, this fantasy, if you will, that amateur golf has gotten so good in this country, and kids are getting so good, so battle-hardened, so polished at such an early age, that it doesn't stretch credulity for me to imagine one actually being in contention at a U.S. Open, at a Masters, at an Open Championship on the weekend. Of course, that's a theme in your book, The Prodigy. Do you think it could happen, or am I just crazy?
No, I don't think you're crazy at all, Charlie, and that's part of the reason why I put together this plot in The Prodigy, because maybe you have to suspend disbelief a little bit to think that a 17-year-old could be in contention on Sunday at the Masters. But remember, the British Open in 2015 at St. Andrews, you had an amateur in the lead after 54 holes, and you had five amateurs in the top 10. After 54 holes, all very young players. Now, none of them won. Zach Johnson ended up winning, as we know. But more and more, you're right, we're seeing young players who have played so much amateur golf and so much college golf come to the fore early in their pro careers or even while they're still amateurs. Jordan Spieth finished T16 at the Byron Nelson when he was 16 in high school. And Ty Tryon, years ago, made it through PGA Tour Q School when he was 17. Probably shouldn't have turned pro, probably should have gone to college, but he was good enough to compete with pros at the age of 17. So when I was writing The Prodigy, my thought was a 17-year-old competing to win the Masters, not likely, but not completely impossible. And that's why throughout the book, you know, I keep quoting Rory McIlroy, who's one of the real people who appears in the book, is saying, hey, you know what? This kid's good enough to win now, not in 5 years or 10 years. He's good enough to win now, because it's not crazy to say something like that.
You mentioned Ty Tryon. To me, he's the ultimate cautionary tale. And you said, you know, he probably should have gone to college. That's something that's repeated over and over again throughout your book as the prodigy, Frank. All he really wants to do is play golf and to go play college golf. And he states it over and over again. And time and again, whether it be Brent Snedeker or other people in the world of golf mentioned to him, Tom Watson, whoever, they all tell him, hey, go to college. Go to college. Right. Is this a universal that you witness out there, that regardless of how good the kid is, all of them say, man, don't grow up so fast. Go to college.
Yes, and I'll tell you why. Because it isn't so much about your ability to play golf inside the ropes. Ty Tryon was good enough, as we said, to get through Q School. There have been other teenagers who have turned pro and been good enough as golfers to compete. But even Tiger Woods, the greatest player of all time, went to Stanford for 2 years and still had all sorts of issues, as we now know, off the golf course, age of 20. So I don't think there's any doubt. The thing that players say all the time is, if you're good enough, you don't need to turn pro at the age of 18. There's no big rush. And, you know, there's always the temptation, if people are throwing a lot of money at you, whether it's, you know, Nike or any of the big-time shoe companies or any corporate sponsor or people who want to pay you guarantees to play overseas, sure, that money is tempting, especially for parents. But long-term, if you're thinking long-term about your kid's future, then you don't turn them pro that early. Look what happened to Michelle Wee, you know, who was so good at the age of 13 and turned pro before she went to college and was miserable out there. Only after she went to Stanford did she sort of get her act together and become not a great player, because she can't putt, but a good player. Lexi Thompson is somewhat of an exception to the rule. I thought she turned pro too young, but she's been able to handle most of the pressure out there. But she would be the outlier in that.
John Feinstein is the author of The Prodigy. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. I'm glad you brought up the equipment companies. In a lot of ways, there are themes throughout The Prodigy that read like a cautionary tale. I knew that equipment companies had access to amateurs and can set them up with equipment. One thing that I was unaware of was the access that agents have to kids when they're amateurs. They can come on legally as quote-unquote advisors.
Right.
How much of this is actually going on?
Oh, a lot.
Oh, wow.
A lot. I mean, you see all sorts of play. You know, you go, if you go to the NCAA tournament, for example, or if you go to the U.S. Amateur, probably a better example even, you will see agents everywhere. And again, as you said, the rules don't prevent them from having contact with the players. I mean, one of the dumbest things that the NCAA is about to do in basketball is to give agents more access to players than they've had in the past. The theory being that way the sleazy agents won't have an advantage by contacting players while the non-sleazy agents are playing by the rules. Well, I understand that theory, but even the non-sleazy agents are sleazy, Charlie. You know that.
Yes.
So here, excuse me, and in golf, as you said, and as the book says, it's not against the rules. In fact, you know the thing in the book where Frank Baker's dad, Thomas, is going on the payroll of the mythical group Double Eagles Double Eagle Inc. As a quote junior talent scout, that's based on truth
because that's
Earl Woods was a talent scout for IMG, quote unquote, while Tiger was in high school. And the big joke in golf is, hey, he did his job very well. He delivered the greatest junior in history.
I'm glad you brought up the Thomas Baker. He, to me, is one of the most interesting characters in your book. And maybe it's because I'm a dad and my kid plays golf. But at his core, he seems to be a good man who loves his son. They've been a two-man team, basically raised him as a single father. Yet he is the one, not the player, he is the one that is seduced by the dark side of the force, by these advisors. And all his son wants to do is play golf and go to college. I know that this all comes from experience. You write from experience. Is it as sleazy in person to watch these vultures come between families as it is to read?
Yeah, it can be painful because the point I was trying to make in creating Thomas Baker, who in many ways is a composite of many parents, is that you can understand the temptation. You know, when people are throwing money at your feet, people are telling you how great you are, people are telling you how great your child is and how they're going to take care of your child and they're going to make your child a star and you're going to be able to retire and never work again. You can understand the tempting notion there. But with Thomas Baker, I think most parents genuinely love their kids and want what's best for their kids, but they can get blinded by what is being thrown at their feet and by people charming them and sucking up to them and telling them how great they are and that they're never wrong about anything. So I tried in the book to depict the fact that Thomas Baker, the father, is in many ways kind of a tortured figure because the money is dazzling him. There's no question about it. And he's thinking, I can retire. I can buy a big house in Florida. I can just play golf. I have people lapping up to me all the time. But on the other hand, he's got his son saying, Dad, I don't want this. This isn't what I want. I want to play golf. I love to play golf. But I want to go to college. I want to be a normal kid. I want to date girls. I want to have a childhood. And that's the danger, is that kids lose their childhoods. And it's not unique to golf. It's worse in tennis. I mean, you have all sorts of tennis players turning pro. In fact, I always ask this trivia question. Do you know who the last American player, male player, to win a Grand Slam tournament who was a college graduate is? If you do, you're very unusual.
McEnroe?
Arthur Ashe.
Ashe.
Who graduated from UCLA in 1963.
Wow.
And I remember asking John McEnroe once why he played Davis Cup all the time. And he said he made his mother two promises when he was in high school. One was to graduate from college, and the other was to play Davis Cup. And he said, when I dropped out of Stanford after my freshman year, I figured I damn well better play Davis Cup.
John Feinstein is the author of The Prodigy, our guest taking Dead Aim. John, golf is as fiction, I think it's harder to write than other sports because a field is a field. A basketball court, a football gridiron, a baseball diamond. On the field of play, they are unchanged no matter where you are in the world. Golf is different. Every course is different. And I got to give you great credit here because the two courses in your book are Riviera and Augusta National, especially Augusta. We all know every nook and cranny of every hole, so it's easy to envision all the action you describe. And the holes that you chose to use at Riviera are iconic ones as well, especially number 10. Was this done on purpose and with that intent in mind?
Absolutely. I hope this book will have broad appeal, but I know a lot of its appeal is going to be to golf fans. And one of the things as a reader that I have always enjoyed in fiction is to read it and say, I've been to the Final Four, so this looks and sounds like a Final Four. I've been to Wimbledon. This looks and sounds like Wimbledon. So in writing fiction about golf, I want a golf fan to say, I know what you mentioned, the 10th hole of Riviera is like. That's always a big featured hole every year during the tournament there because it's one of the great short par fours in golf, as is number 3 at Augusta National. So I wanted to describe these holes in a way that a golf fan who's either watched on TV or played at Riviera or played at Augusta, if they've been lucky enough to do that, could sit back and go, yeah, that's right. You know, people who watch the Masters every year would say, yeah, the hole location on Sunday is always front left on 18. So that it sounds like I know what I'm talking about. I've covered 27 Masters. I've been to Riviera on many occasions. So I hope I know what I'm talking about.
Just off subject for a second, is it a more fun or calming exercise for you to write fiction than what you normally do in doing the great nonfiction work that you do?
It's very different, Charlie. I'm lucky. I enjoy both. I think by doing both, it keeps me fresh. Because I'll finish grinding out a nonfiction book. Like I have a book coming out on quarterbacking in the NFL in November. And then I know for a while I don't have to go on the road. I don't have to set up interviews. I don't have to try to get people to give me, you know, large chunks of their time, because when I write the fiction, my reporting is based, is done, because my reporting is based on my career and all the years I've spent knowing athletes and coaches and going to all these events we're talking about. And then the challenge is different. The challenge is coming up with a storyline that people are going to want to follow. So I like having a different challenge. I also like the idea that for a few months my office every day is right here in my house, as opposed to going on the road somewhere. I'm old, Charlie. I like being at home.
John Feinstein is author of The Prodigy, our guest taking Dead Aim. Back to the book for a second. You did change some names, especially where Augusta National was concerned,
yep.
Much to a big smile on my face, having lived and worked in Augusta for 5.5 years. But there are many real names with actual dialogue and situations used. Did you ask permission in advance, or did you get sort of a tentative okay, but let me read it first? How did you go about that?
When dealing with real characters in all my fiction, almost always they're people I'm friendly with or friends with, and people who I know won't object to having a fictional role in one of my books. Now, I will give them a heads up. You know, I will say, for example, one of the less famous people in the book is Steve DiMeglio from USA Today.
I loved that, by the way.
And Steve's a buddy of mine. And as you notice, every time he appears, the last thing he says is, "I gotta go smoke." And that's because that is always the last thing Steve says to you when you have a conversation with him. So, of course, I gave him a heads up. I gave not only gave Rory McIlroy a heads up, I gave him a copy of the book. And I said, there's a surprise ending. I think you'll like it. But I didn't tell him what it was.
Right.
You know, and all the other guys who appear, from USGA officials, Mike Davis, people like that, to other players, Zach Johnson, Justin Rose, Tom Watson, you mentioned, who, as you know, I'm very close to. I gave them all a heads up that they appear in the book. And I also make sure when I'm dealing with real characters that they don't do anything objectionable.
Right.
Like, I would not have a real character be involved in the incident that takes place at the U.S. Amateur, obviously, in the semifinals. That person had to be fictionalized. And I fictionalized the Augusta National members because, as you know, I kind of make fun of them in the book. And I figure, why get into any kind of battle with them other than saying, hey, fellas, come on, we should all be able to have a good laugh about this. But maybe they'll kick me out. Who knows?
I don't want to give too much away here, but there's a John Feinstein-esque journalist, maybe a young John Feinstein-esque journalist.
This guy's a much better golfer than John Feinstein.
He's a big part of the story, and you already brought it up, the fictional playing of the U.S. Amateur, where he, in a couple of ways, becomes unwittingly part of the story.
Right.
The second part is the most egregious, and I'm not going to give anything away here, but have you ever witnessed a rules infraction or felt like really one may have taken place and mm-hmm. you did nothing?
And where I did nothing.
Yes.
Nothing on that level, that's for sure.
Yeah.
There have been moments where I've seen things happen and wondered if I witnessed a rules infraction. And would, you know, eventually ask a rules official, this is what I think I saw, was it a rules infraction? And almost all the time it's not. Players usually know what they're doing. But if I ever witness something like what takes place in Los Angeles in the book, I would feel obligated to do what my fictional character does in the book. You can't allow that to pass if somebody's cheating. I mean, it's an incident involving out and out cheating. Most of the time, as you know, when rules get broken, it's inadvertent.
Yes. You rarely, like, again, we're going to give too much away, and I promised I wouldn't do that. John Feinstein is the author of The Prodigy, our guest taking Dead Aim. The authenticity that permeates your book, I really enjoy, especially, I always like being able to pull back the curtain on Oz for people sometimes and tell them exactly the way things are. And in this case, I think you did this for all of us who have ever hung out in a media tent. You do a tremendous job in detailing the access that the media has with players and at the locations at which we have access at tournaments. Did you do this just as an homage for all of us who have suffered? Or are there places and events that you attend annually that you just loathe for this reason and you had to get it out of your system?
Well, I mean, as you know, Augusta is different than other golf tournaments because it's the only golf tournament in the world where we can't walk inside the ropes.
Right.
I mean, the Augusta National people are very firm on this. Nobody goes inside the ropes other than players and caddies. If a rules official is needed, they call for him or her, and then they come inside the ropes. We don't have access to the champions' locker room. We don't have access to the range or the putting green. It makes doing my job harder during Masters Week, frankly. But the people at the Masters have a very simple philosophy. It's our golf tournament. We run it the way we want to run it. And if you don't like the way we run it, you are welcome not to come.
That's exactly the
way. And frankly, I don't have a problem with that.
No.
I mean, it is their golf tournament.
Absolutely.
As I said, it makes my job harder to do than other weeks on the golf tour. But I go there knowing that. So I go there prepared for that. And you know, I talk about the cell phone rule in the book. I think the cell phone rule is a little bit ridiculous in today's world where, you know, literally, I remember my friend Dave Kindred walking out of the media center one year, and we were going to the parking lot. We were leaving, and it was 7 o'clock in the evening, maybe later than that. And his wife called, and so instinctively he reached for his phone, and he got two steps outside and was just about tackled, you know, and was fortunate if they'd thrown him out that day, it wouldn't have mattered. But I just think they go a little over the top with some of their rules. But again, that's who they are. It's their tournament. If I never show up at Augusta again, believe me, nobody's going to bat an eye. I understand that.
Get you out of here on this. There's so many anecdotes and stories contained within the book, The Prodigy, that ring so true. At the risk of sounding ridiculous, I've got to ask about them. Number one is the great quote from the Palestra: to win the game is great, to play the game is greater, but to love the game is the greatest of all. And Jordan Spieth incorporates this in a speech to the Drive Chip and Putt kids. It sounds like something so Jordan that I almost want to say, this had to have happened. I know it didn't, but I had to ask, did it happen?
No, I made it up.
Oh, but doesn't that sound like something he would do, though, John?
Not only does it sound like something he said, he would say, but his brother did play at Brown.
Yes.
So he played in the Palestra for 4 years. So that would give the Spieth family familiarity with the Palestra. So I didn't think it was a stretch to put those words in Jordan's mouth. And I'll use any excuse to get the Palestra into a book, because my wife has always said she's not afraid I will leave her for another woman, but she does worry sometimes I would leave her to move into the Palestra.
And the story of Mike Weir and the shower and hosting the Champions
Dinner.
That's
a true story.
Okay, that is so great. Can you just reiterate that real quick?
The year Mike Weir was the defending champion in 2004, and obviously the defending champion hosts the Champions Dinner on Tuesday night. He picks the menu. He's the host. You know that. That's part of a Masters legend. And on Tuesday night, Mike was on the range grinding on his swing because he was struggling a little bit. And he looked up and looked at his watch, and it was 6:30. The dinner starts at 7. And he went, oh, my God, you know. And he runs into the Champions locker room, which he was in for the first time that year, sweating and desperately needing a shower before he gets dressed. Well, the Champions locker room only has one shower in it because, you know, guys don't take showers all that often. But the night of the Champions dinner, he comes in, Arnold Palmer is in the shower. Jack Nicklaus and Tom Watson are waiting for the shower. And as Weir said, that wasn't a line I felt I could cut. He had to wait until each of them was finished with their shower before he could get under the shower, probably for about 2 minutes, and get dressed for the dinner. Fortunately, he only had to walk a few steps to get to the dinner once he had showered. But no, that story's 100% true.
That was fantastic. One quick one here to end it. Your story to me ends on kind of a cliffhanger. Are we to assume that Frank is playing golf for Casey Martin at Oregon?
I think that's a good assumption to make. I do. I think that clearly he could go anywhere he wants. You hope that he'll be playing college golf. There's a little bit of a cliffhanger in that, as you point out. And I put Casey Martin in the book because he's been so successful as Oregon's golf coach, but also because I got to know Casey when I was doing my Q School book back in 2005, and when he was dealing with the Supreme Court on the golf cart issue. And I've never met a better guy in sports. So, again, as I said, I try to incorporate real people who I like and am friends with into these books. So it was kind of natural to put Casey in as a guy who might be recruiting Frank Baker to come play for him.
I don't like to throw this word around, but he is great. That's John Feinstein, author of The Prodigy. And up next, a local artisan and craftsman. Ken Hissom takes dead aim at putter and club restoration, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Hey, we're taking dead aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. When it comes to putter and club restoration here in the Queen City, there's only one name you need to know. Ken Hissom at kickstandputters.com. Ken, it's been a couple of years since we've talked about you and your business, and in that time, it's really grown. We'll get to that in a second. But one thing that I've never asked you before, to do what you do, to refinish and these putters, and I know you do other clubs as well, but putters is really your primary thing. It's a love affair, a person and their putter. It has to be your favorite club in the bag, I would think. Where did your love affair with putters begin?
Oh, it had to be with my mom and dad, who I was the youngest of six. So I would tag along with them, and I was kind of there's a 8 year, 9 year difference between me and the fifth kid. So what they did was they were golf banshees, and they would take me to the golf course, and they would hire a caddy to babysit me, and I would just sit on the putting green. We just putted together. I remember that, my earliest thing. So that's where I fell in love with the putters. That's where I fell in love with the putter. I can tell you exactly which one I had. I had a Tommy Armour IMGL, and I putted with that as a little kid from the age of, 5 or 6 on up to my early teens.
Most of us go through several putters in their golfing life, but there's that one that always stays in the garage, stays in the office, stays around because it goes in and out of the bag. My son asked me one time about it, and I said, the best way to equate it is this. Putters are a lot like women. You can date a lot of women, and you can have a lot of fun with a lot of women, but there's only one soulmate that you're going to have.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's like, I can remember my, it's funny, my first kiss with a girl, and I can remember her name, and it's that first taste of, dropping a 20-footer, and the one that would come through for you on the putting green early on, and that's the one you save. Then, the new models come out, so you're like, oh, maybe that one will work, and it really doesn't meet that first experience that you had with the putter. So to kind of use that metaphor, I still have that Tommy Armour IMGL in my closet.
That's what I was going to ask you, if you still held on to that putter.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. My dad gave it to me. He's passed away since. And I pull it out every once in a while and can remember playing in 1984 with him and a member using that putter. So there's a lot of memories that kind of, those golfers out there that there's memories attached to this. So that's my saying. It's not only do I restore putters, I also restore some memories.
Did you restore that Tommy armor, or have you left it as it was?
I left it as it was because now he gave me another one, a Tommy Armor IMG 5 that I have restored. But that first one, I kept it just so that, you know, there was a couple dings and nicks in it that he put in by accident. So I just, that one I kind of kept the way it was when I first saw it.
Ken Hissom is the man behind KickstandPutters.com. Check out his website. See the work he does. It's an artist's work. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. A lot of people, before I met you, a lot of people, our only thing options were to send some things off to Golf Works up in Ohio or to send them back to the Scotty Cameron studio in California. Not to say they don't do a great job. They do, but their backlog has gotten so great now that you could be without a putter for 2 or 3 months at a time waiting for it to come back. What is the average when someone says, hey, can you do this for me? What's the average time it takes you to redo a putter?
About 3.5 weeks, 3.5 to 4. Now, if I have to do a PVD coating, we're looking at four weeks. And those who are not familiar with PVD, that's it's kind of like Ricky Fowler's black irons, right? And so that's going to take about, at the most, 4 weeks.
One thing that I have noticed that has come a long way in recent years, and I really wanted to talk with you about this. I can remember when stainless steel putters came out, and I can remember people saying, man, I'd really like this. I'd really like to get it refinished with this. The word on the street was there wasn't a finish that would adhere to the stainless steel, so you really couldn't do anything with it, and that's not the case anymore.
No, we have, you know, we have PVD. We also have DLC, which is a derivative of kind of a offshoot of PVD. We also have Cerakote, not as strong as the other ones mentioned, but with Cerakote, they use ceramic coating that they use a lot on guns. And so, you know, if you take care of it and use a head cover, that will last a long time.
Ken, is there a putter that's come in to your workshop that the owner, when he dropped it off, basically said, I don't know what you can do with this. Just do the best you can. And then when they came and picked it up, there were almost tears in their eyes. Have you had that experience?
I've had, and this is the best part of it. You know, I can tell you the putter. It was a Ben Hogan Little Ben putter.
Oh, wow.
It's almost like the old Calamity Jane putter.
Yes, I know exactly,
you know,
what you're talking
like
about.
Almost like a picket chipper. And his grandfather gave it to him. And so he goes, hey, I just want to kind of make this look pretty good. And, you know, I researched the putter and put a nice high chrome finish on it and then kind of matted the face and, you know, put the same coloring in there and put a new ferrule on it and gave it to him. And there's some tears. His eyes watered up. And that's the best part, is just to, you know, exceed their expectations, knock them dead. And that was a lot of fun for me. It reminded me of every time I pull out that Tommy Armor IMGL, that, you know, that I get a little, man, I had the best time with my dad on the golf course.
Now, this is going to sound kind of weird, but I know with the meticulous work that you do, you almost kind of have a bond with your work. It's like an artist with their creation. Are there times that you've worked so hard and you've brought a putter back to life and back to, you know, original specs, or you've made it even better than before, that you almost hate the owner to come and pick it up?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it goes back to, you know, I like the blade putters. There's a couple 8802s I've done that I was like, you know, can I buy this one from you? And he goes, no, I have the memory from it. But, you know, that's my business plan, or not my business plan, but my goal all along was I wanted to give you a putter, and this sounds horrible, but I want to give you a putter that you don't want to use because it looks too good. And I've gotten a couple of those, but every putter I get, that's the effort I put into it. I want to make it look so good that you're like, man, I can't use this. I'm just going to put this on the shelf or put this on the, you know, in my display rack or something like that. So, that's my goal with every putter.
The website is kickstandputters.com. You can see all the prices and finishes there. The man is Ken Hissom. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Now, since we talked a couple of years ago, you've branched out, and I see on your website you're also doing some refinishing of irons. When did you start doing that?
I started doing that a little bit just right after, about a year after I started doing the putters. You know, started getting into doing those old Wilson 8802s or the Dynapower. The Wilson staff and the Dynapower and the Ben Hogan irons. One of those, you know, from the 60s, 70s, and early 80s. In 90s. Nowadays, there's a lot of pieces to it, right? There's some composite material, and those are really hard to do. But you know, it's going back to the old school golf, restoring those, and I get a kick out of that.
Yeah, I remembered, I was looking at your pictures, and I remembered I still have the set of Ben Hogan Apex blades that I got for graduating high school in 1988. And through years and moves and what have you, they had gotten in disrepair and were awful. And I sent them back not too many years ago and got them refinished. And I remember when they came back in the mail and I looked at those heads and it was, oh, my God, this is just what they looked like when they when they came out of the box. And it was an unbelievable feeling to look down and see those historic irons looking brand new again.
Yeah. And I think from the last time, if I could segue a little bit, the last time we spoke, I was just getting into the face milling, right? Remilling the putter face. So with today's putters, there's a lot of face milling. Most everyone that you get, there's some kind of milling into it. So with that, I've done some research and worked with a couple guys, learned some stuff, and I can do any kind of face milling that you want to have done to the putter, whether it's deep milling, you know, any kind of pattern that you want in there. And then I can also do milling in your names or initials or any kind of design that you want. So, for example, like with the Newports, right, the Scotty Newports, there's bumpers on the back of the putter. And a lot of times I can fill those in and put in and mill in your name, you know, whether it's Charlie or Ken or if you have a saying or your school. I've done one for Auburn and put War on one bumper, Eagle on another. So I've been branching out with that as well.
I'm interested in paint fill because I don't think I could keep my hand steady enough to do some of the paint fill that I see that you've done on your website. What are some of the oddest color combinations that you've had requested?
Oh, wow. I've had a lot of them. You know, from all black, black on black, they called Murdered Out, you know, black and pink. I've done some, one that looks like an Easter egg. And I have done one going with that Cerakote that I was talking about. I made the whole putter look like one of those cars that change colors when you twist it in the light.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
They've come out with some Cerakote colors that if you apply it, let it cure, and you can twist the putter around, and it'll change from blue to green to purple and things like that. So I've done something like that with some odd paint fills. But my favorite paint fill are those translucent colors. You know, Scotty started it with the translucent red, and I could do purple, you know, green, yellow, orange, and blue, and those turn out really cool.
Are most of the finishes that you're doing now, are they fairly weather resistant, or do you still have to take some care in feeding with some of them?
The one that you have to take, most of them are weather resistant, right? So like the early Scotties, they're mainly carbon steel, and carbon steel will rust, right? That's just the science of the metal. So what I could do is I can plate it with nickel or chrome. I can also Cerakote it, and PVD will help it as well. But if you compromise it, scrape it, ding it pretty well, then, you know, it's going to expose some of the carbon. But as long as you put that, you know, cover on it, keep it in your hands after you three putt, it should well pretty well. The only thing that you really need to be conscious on is the black oxide. And that's what Scotty used early on. with the black putters in the 90s.
Visit his website, kickstandputters.com. Ken Hissom's work is exceptional and reasonably priced. I also hope you enjoyed revisiting our chats with Jim Moriarty and John Feinstein. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show and wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice most weeks, just minutes after this terrestrial radio version of the show finishes airing. Also, a great way to stay in the loop with us is to be a regular consumer of our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Currently featured there, articles on Tiger's equipment changes for the WGC event this week and the PGA Tour's new dress code. Shorts, anyone? Weather-wise, well, it looks like a sloppy go of it at best. But if somehow you find a way to put a peg in the ground this weekend, remember, exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy. And I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.